The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
All right, good morning. I'm Bob Goldman. I teach at the law school. And just to make sure, just like when you get an airline flight, you are here for countering terrorism through domestic and international targeted sanctions, a rule of law perspective. So if you were expecting something else, now's the time to bail out. But it's my pleasure to introduce the dean of our law school, Claudio Grossman, to say a few words of welcome. And then Christian Benavesser, who is from the permanent mission of Liechtenstein to the United Nations, and that government has been our partner in this conference, and indeed this would not have happened without really the considerable assistance of Christian and his staff. So we're very thankful for that. Dean Grossman.
Thank you.
On behalf of American University Washington College of Law, good morning and welcome to this conference, Countering Terrorism Through Domestic and International Sanctions, a Rule of Law Perspective. At our law school, we consider as an important part of our mission providing a forum for the discussion of key issues of our time, to exchange ideas while enhancing the dialogue and understanding of issues that affect us both as a society and as individuals. This approach also offers great promise for tackling important challenges and finding workable solutions. Serving as a forum for open, respectful dialogue takes on particular importance given that virtually every issue today has a legal component. So we see as part of our strategic vision then enhancing the quality of the public debate by providing a forum where we exchange views on key issues of our time. The law school hosts numerous conferences and events each year on a wide range of important topics, such as today's. We host in the law school over 80 conferences during the year, attracting more than 7,000 judges and practitioners, academics, and the public at large. In addition, we multiply the outreach of these conferences through webcasting and podcasting. It is fitting in that framework that we have the opportunity to host a discussion on the complex issue of countering terrorism within a rule of law perspective, given our commitment in general to talk about issues facing humankind, but also because of the importance of the topics per se. I don't need to tell this audience that in our view there is not a valid cause for the terrorism. There are thousands of valid causes and nobody doubts his or her own. But the key thing is always this tremendous advancement of civilization, that there are certain things that cannot be done, and that in particular, if you take a rule of law perspective and a democratic perspective, it is compatible to pursue values of human dignity with satisfying high norms of human dignity. As a matter of fact, perhaps for democracies and for those who pursue rule of law objectives, those two things are indivisible. And that's the moral and ethical and legal superiority of democracy. The fact that we can face terrorism and make that face compatible with human rights and with values of human dignity. We look forward to today's exchanges. We hope that they are going to highlight more that they need to be unified with a common purpose and to find workable solutions in the goal towards the goal of fighting terrorism while safeguarding both human dignity and human rights as well as international security. We are honored to have so many distinguished panelists and guests participating today. Each of you represent a wide array of institutions and countries. The diversity and depth of experience will provide unique insights on these issues and vital perspectives on the resolution. Thank you all for your participation. We are proud to co-sponsor this event with the government of Liechtenstein, and we greatly value this collaboration. I would like to thank Ambassador Claudia Fritsch, who is here. She came first with the idea to organize this conference. We thank the ambassador for the thanking and the possibility of law school contributing to this discussion. I want to thank also Christian Wennerbesser, permanent representative of Liechtenstein to the United Nations. Those of us who know him know that he's in the forefront of the important debates in the United Nations, and we are greatly honored for also by his presence here. Stefan Barriga, legal advisor, permanent mission of Liechtenstein to the UN, and René Brockhart, head of financial intelligence unit of Liechtenstein to the United Nations. I want to thank our offices here at the law school, the Office of Special Events and Continuing Legal Education, that has not the small task to coordinating more than 8 events per year, as I mentioned before, and Professor Robert Goldman for his vision and leadership in bringing this event to fruition. Both accomplishments in this field are far too numerous to list. However, among them are his position as one of the 8 eminent jurists on the International Commission of Jurists Panel on Terrorism, whose mandate is to examine the responses to terrorism since the September 11th attack and their compatibility with international law. From July 2004 to July 2005, Bob was the UN Human Rights Commission's independent expert on the protection of human rights and fundamental freedom while countering terrorism. I was fortunate also to serve with Bob in the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, and Bob was there crucial to the develop of the norms of supervision to develop also a legal framework. The Commission adopted a very authoritative report on terrorism that is really interesting to be read, and he played a crucial role in its adoption. Well, once again, I would like to thank all of you for joining us, and I'm sure that today's conference will be interesting, enlightening, and opening possibilities for all of us to continue pursuing important values of dignity. Thank you very much, and Bob, I invite you back.
Thank you, Todd.
Good morning, everybody, and thanks for coming, and thank you, Claudio, for your introductory remarks. I'll just add a few things. I'll have a chance to be on one of the panels this afternoon to present our engagement and our ideas on this topic. Since 9/11, there have been probably numerous articles on the issue of human rights and terrorism. It has been one of the most discussed topics, and usually, of course, it is seen more in the context of discussions about issues like detention in Guantanamo and perhaps also the Patriot Act. So these are things that you are all very familiar with. There is one other aspect that will be the focus of our attention today, and that is the fight against terrorism through cutting off the financing of terrorism. And as you will know, perhaps, or will learn in the course of today, the UN has, through its Security Council, adopted a sanctions regime to prevent the funding of terrorist activities. And this, we believe, is in principle a very important and very effective tool. The financing of terrorism is one of the important means to combat terrorism. But at the same time, we have had human rights concerns about the practice that the Security Council has adopted for a number of years. And this is why we, as a mission in New York, got together with people that are like-minded on this topic. Those were initially Switzerland, Denmark, and Sweden. And at the later stage, we were joined also by the Netherlands and by Germany. And we put forward a number of due process concerns, and in particular, we claimed that the practice of the Security Council violates the right of individuals to be heard and also the right to a judicial review. You may have seen that the European Court of Justice just a few days ago, I think it was on the 3rd of September, issued a very important judgment on the case of Qadi that will come out in the course of the discussions today. So we believe this is an extremely opportune moment to take this up, and we thank you very much for coming here and for being interested in this. I also want to thank Claudia Grossmann as the dean here for his openness to host us and for his interest in doing this, and in particular also Professor Goldman, of course. In some ways, this is full circle for us, because Professor Goldman was the first expert ever who held a mandate on counterterrorism and human rights in the context of the United Nations. That is a young mandate that was created in 2002. We were at the time very important. We played an important role in framing the mandate together with Mexico at the time, and it was Professor Goldman who was the first special rapporteur on this. So it would be very difficult to find someone who's more suitable to take the lead today than him, and I'm very grateful to him for his personal commitment. I also want to thank his team and my own team, and I think it's been a very good and very uncomplicated way to work together to put this event together. And last but not least, I would like to thank our ambassador in Washington, Ambassador Fritsche, because she put us in touch here, and we would not be here without her today. So these are my opening remarks, and I very much look forward to an interesting day and to the first panel. Bob.
Thank you so much, Christian. The first panel really is going to help to set the stage for the subsequent, the afternoon's panels, and it's on domestic and international targeted sanction regimes, a comparison. And we really have three very well qualified people to deal with this. You'll see you have bios on all of the speakers, but I'm going to give a brief introduction of all three. Each will then speak for a period of 15 minutes. They'll have an opportunity for an exchange and then questions from the floor. But the first speaker today is Adam J. Zubin, who was named the Director of Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control by U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson on August 1, 2006. Well, I'm glad he named you in August 1, because he's been a very busy individual in the last couple of days. I guess he wishes he was probably back at Goldman Sachs these days. In that role, Mr. Zubin is responsible for administering and enforcing the U.S. government's economic sanctions programs to advance foreign policy and national security objectives. And during his tenure at Treasury, Mr. Zubin has served as senior advisor to the Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. He came to Treasury from the Department of Justice, where he served as counsel to the Deputy Attorney General, coordinating the department's efforts to combat terrorism financing. Our second speaker is Mr. Stephen Marquardt, who is Deputy Head and Legal Advisor of the UN Liaison Office of the Council of the European Union in New York. He joined the General Secretariat of the Council in 1993, where he was a member of the Council Legal Service until his posting to New York in October of 2007. Since 1998, he has dealt with all the legal instruments and procedures of the EU's common foreign and security policy, in particular in the field of sanctions and counterterrorism. And before joining the Council of European Union, Mr. Marquardt worked for the U.S. law firm of Baker & McKenzie in Frankfurt. And the last speaker will be Joanna Wechsler, who is a native of Poland and has lived in the United States since 1982. In Poland, she was a reporter for the Solidarity Union press agency, in charge of covering most meetings between the Union President, Lech Walesa, and the communist government, and meetings of the executive leadership of the Union. She is currently the Director of Research of the Security Council Report, a recently established organization affiliated with Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. And from 1994 until 2005, Ms. Wechsler was the United Nations representative for Human Rights Watch. She was also very much involved with other Human Rights Watch programs, director of its prison project, and I had the great luck when I was on the board of, we used to call it America's Watch. Everything's a slash these days. But what I like to think of is the glory days of America's Watch back in the 80s and so forth. She was the Brazil researcher for America's Watch. And so welcome to all of you. Mr. Zuman, you have the floor.
Thank you.
And you could speak from here or you could go there, whatever you like, whatever you feel more comfortable. You have the option of standing or?
Okay. I'm going to speak from here after a quick consultation with my colleagues. Everything happens democratically when it comes to sanctions, and as this quick process just illustrated for you. Thank you very much for the introduction. Thank you to American University and to the Embassy of Liechtenstein for arranging this conference. It's an incredibly important topic, and I'm honored to be here. I'm very much honored to be in the presence of such distinguished colleagues. The people who I saw on the agenda speaking today really represent the finest experts around the world on these issues, and it's rare to see them all together in one place. So I really am quite pleased to be here, and I appreciate it on behalf of our office, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, and the Treasury Department. My topic for today is the U.S. process for designating those who are supporters of terrorism. And I want to take you through that as briefly as I can, although there are a lot of steps to it, and then maybe conclude with a few remarks about the broader topic that we're all focused on today. The process of designating an individual begins with intelligence when you're talking about terrorism. We administer close to 30 sanctions programs, among them sanctions against WMD, sanctions against narco-traffickers, and the targeting process differs pretty markedly among these programs just because of the nature of those threat areas. When you're talking about narcotics traffickers, most of our information will come in from law enforcement agencies within the U.S. and their colleague officers overseas. In the world of terrorism, of course, the expertise and the information tends to come from intelligence, both U.S. and foreign. And because of that, those in Treasury who are doing the real nuts and bolts targeting of different terrorist groups and their support networks are inextricably tied in with the broader intelligence community, both in terms of access to data and in terms of consultation. The focus tends to differ somewhat in that the people who, for example, sit at the CIA and are watching the courier networks of Al-Qaeda have an underlying objective of getting at the recipients of that money, identifying where they are, where they'll be in a few weeks so that they can potentially be apprehended or stopped, and how can we disrupt that funding flow. But the flow is often viewed as a means to an end. And when we're engaged in the sanctions process against terrorist financiers, the flow is a means unto itself. It's critically important for us to be able to target the conduits and those who are raising the money, those who are donating the money, and those who are, for example, acting as front companies or corrupt charities that are allowing these funds to flow, because that's where we can have our leverage and our impact. If there's a suicide bomber in Pakistan, the U.S. Treasury Department putting he or she on a list is not going to mean much to them. It's certainly not going to provide a deterrence beyond what the deterrence would be of suicide. But when you're talking about those who are raising money and moving money, they tend to be of a different background and want to keep their one foot in the legitimate world, we often say. And so for them, it's critical that they have access to international commercial opportunities, that they have access to international financial institutions. And the leverage can be quite significant indeed if we can add someone like that to a sanctions list in terms of the disruptive impact. And of course, the disruptive impact when it's a multilateral sanctions action, such as those by jurisdictions like the EU and certainly such as those by the UN, are immeasurably more powerful and contain travel bans and all these other aspects you'll be hearing about today. But in any case, We have experts who are studying these facilitation networks to try to identify who the key individuals are or key companies for targeting. And targeting, at the end of the day, meaning designation on a state or a Treasury Department, in a state or a Treasury Department action that will lead to the name being published in a public list that we call the Specially Designated Nationals List, and lead to immediate consequences, legal consequences, in terms of a prohibition on any dealings for U.S. persons with the designated individual. Also, a requirement that any U.S. person here or worldwide must immediately block or freeze the assets of the individuals who are named. So let me take you through how this happens, and the theme that you'll hear emerging is this is a collaborative effort, because it very much is. When we begin looking at a target, we tend to do that primarily in conversations with our intelligence colleagues, as I mentioned. But pretty quickly, after there's an idea of here's a corrupt charity that's been financing Al-Qaeda that we think is a very ripe target for designation, that name is brought to an interagency group. And within the U.S. government, the interagency group includes, of course, the State Department, the Treasury Department, the Justice Department, the entire intelligence community, the FBI, and other key law enforcement groups that are working on terrorism, and it's chaired out of the White House by the National Security Council. The first question that's brought up is this a good target? Are there concerns? Is this a good target means, do we really think it would be worth our time and effort, because it takes quite a bit of effort to go after this person? And are there concerns can raise a whole number of types of concerns, such as intelligence equities. We may have the CIA say to us, yes, you've alighted on a very bad individual. It happens to be we've been watching this person for a year now, and we're obtaining very good information from them. Or we don't want to spook them because we're planning something that would happen a few months from now, and for the U.S. to take this very public action against them might change their plans. So that's the type of objection or equity that might be raised by our intelligence. You can imagine similar concerns raised from our law enforcement colleagues. And then broader policy concerns. When you're talking, for example, in the context of Iraq, where we're both targeting terrorist groups and insurgent groups, it's a very dynamic situation, as is the situation in Afghanistan. Allegiances are shifting, alliances are shifting, and we may not want to target a group that today is engaged in violence, but that we think might actually be a constructive partner a few months from now. That's clearly a type of concern that would be raised at the table when we're having these interagency discussions. But if a green light is given to go ahead, the analyst and the analysts who work on our terrorism program sit in what's called Treasury's Office of Intelligence and Analysis, which is a relatively new office. They begin the process of drafting what we call an evidentiary. An evidentiary package is a legal document that assembles all of the known information, both derogatory and exculpatory, about the individual with respect to their ties to terrorism, and sets it out in an organized and coherent way so that a decision maker can look at it at the end of the day and say, I agree that this is a strong case for designation, or I don't. I think you need to bolster this or augment it in some way. That process tends to take months. I know that it's often said that designations are a nimble tool. I think that's true, but the question is in comparison to what? They're a nimble tool when it comes to prosecuting or forfeiting someone's assets, which can be a many-year-long process. Sanctions are faster. It's an administrative process, but we're still typically talking about months. It's the very rare designation that I've seen begin and end within a matter of weeks. I have trouble thinking of one. The evidentiary package, all the exhibits, and then the document itself are then reviewed by multiple layers of reviewers within the various chains of command. It's typically four different layers of review before the document even goes out to be reviewed by lawyers. And those individuals who are reviewing it are looking to see, has the person adduced all of the elements that the relevant executive order requires. In other words, have they shown that this individual or company is acting on behalf of a designated terrorist group, is providing material support to a terrorist group? Or are the allegations somewhat more amorphous, like we have intelligence that individual X is associated with, but there's no substance as to what the association consists of? Does that mean that they were spotted once at a training camp, but we don't know in what capacity? Does that mean that they were engaged in something more tangible, more concrete, and more dangerous? So after those layers of review, if a package clears, it's sent out for legal review. And that means, again, interagency legal review. It will go, if it's a state or treasury package, of course, to that agency's lawyers for initial cut. Once it clears those lawyers, it will go to the Justice Department in all cases. And there is an office there that represents the government in any litigation. And they also serve as pre-designation advisors or consultants with respect to litigation risk and with respect to the strength of a package. All of these steps take time, and I don't know if you're all sitting out there thinking, the government is as bureaucratic as we expected, and I don't want to ever work there, but I actually highly recommend it. It's a terrific line of work. After legal review and we have final sign-off, we're then pretty much decided as a government that we're going to move ahead, and we begin the process of drafting a statement of case. A statement of case is a public summary that is released when we take the final action to not only to the target but to the whole world, explaining the nature of our evidence, the nature of the case against this individual or entity, and also what we call identifiers. So in the case of a company, its place of incorporation, its business address, if it has an EIN number or whatever the equivalent would be in a country, we try to put that out there. In the case of an individual, identifiers mean date of birth, place of birth, country of residence, nationality, passport number if we have it. The more identifiers we can put out there, the better, both with respect to the issues we're talking about today, also with respect to simple implementation. The point of these sanctions is, of course, to work, and that means to catch people's assets, to disrupt wire transactions, in the case of UN designations, to intercept people at the border. And it doesn't help if you designate somebody John Doe and there are 5,000 people in the world with that name and you haven't identified that person with specificity. What we see happening in such cases is banks either block the assets of a lot of innocent people or they just throw up their hands and let all transactions go through. And so even from a parochial perspective of trying to make these sanctions work, we're insistent on getting good identifying information out into the public domain. And because of what I mentioned at the outset, because of the sources of our information, that almost always requires declassification. We'll know that a person's passport number is X because we heard it from a foreign government intelligence service. We need to then go back to that intelligence service and request that they declassify that. That can take weeks. And oftentimes it'll be denied. And then we have a question, is there another way we can get that information? Could we put in a request to an embassy abroad? And we try every which way to be able to get unclassified information out into the public domain. Finally, when we have everything ready, we begin a pre-designation consultative process. Almost all of our designations are focused abroad, although there have been designations of U.S. persons and companies. But typically, when we're focused on the threat of, be it Hamas, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, Jamaat Islamiyah, we're focused on companies and individuals abroad. And in the majority of cases, our action will be far more effective if we can consult in advance with the host government and try to reach some agreement about a strategy to take on this individual. It may not be targeted sanctions with respect to our counterparts. It may be something more routine, like in the case of a financial company, it could be sending in regulators to conduct an in-depth audit or examination to make sure that the company is keeping honest books. It could be launching a law enforcement investigation. It could be something like denying the person travel privileges or putting them under close scrutiny or house arrest. It's taken many forms. At the very least, consultation gives us the ability to avoid taking a host government by surprise, and that in itself is an important value. If we're going to designate at the United Nations, propose designation at the United Nations, we have requirements of pre-notification to all Security Council members, and we take those quite seriously. That's all of the buildup, and it's a lot of steps. It takes quite a bit of time, and the final step is that this evidentiary package is brought, if it's a State Department package, to the relevant official there. If it's the Treasury Department, it comes to my desk for review and for signature. I sign it, and it's published on the web, instantly blasted out to tens of thousands of companies and businesses who have registered to be notified when these designations occur. And 1 minute later, if things are working properly, and typically this works pretty smoothly, if a wire transaction is coming through New York, it'll be frozen. If it was sent for or on behalf of, or if there's an interest of, the designated terrorist. That's the designation process. I'm going to leave off the back-end review in terms of what happens if an individual wants to seek an administrative challenge, and they can do that in our system. What happens if they want to seek a judicial challenge before an Article III court, and they have all those rights as well. I'll leave that to my colleague, Ori Lev, who's going to be speaking on an afternoon panel about the U.S. review process. The only point I would note here is that the administrative review is anything but symbolic. We have removed over 80 individuals from our sanctions list in the last 10 months alone, the great majority of those not under our terrorist program, but under other targeted sanctions programs, such as our narco-trafficking program. But when people come in and say, I'd like to be removed from our list, that's something we have a responsibility and we do take extremely seriously. I have 1 minute remaining. What I wanted to just note, maybe in terms of the bigger picture, is that the issues that I think this whole day is organized around are incredibly challenging. And after 7 years of thinking about them, I certainly don't have any answers. And I think answers are elusive for the reasons that sanctions were not devised historically to target individuals. Sanctions were devised historically to target foreign governments or foreign countries. If you think about the history of sanctions, it's sanctions against Libya, sanctions against South Africa, worldwide or unilateral, or sanctions against governments, or sanctions against individuals in Sudan who are committing atrocities in Darfur. All of that is an evolving process, but it stems from a desire to change the conduct of a foreign, neither national security threat or human rights threat. And I think they can be quite effective. What's happened recently is an evolution towards what we call targeted sanctions, such that rather than go after the entire country of Sudan, there's a UN Security Council resolution that goes after named individuals who are responsible for committing atrocities in Darfur. That's perceived widely as being much more narrow, much more effective. Because when you target an entire country, you, of course, cause harm to innocents who no one is trying to hurt. And isn't it more effective and more powerful if we can go after just those who are culpable, whose behavior we're trying to change? And I think the answer is a clear yes. And so you see an evolution across our programs to targeting. What comes with that, though, is something that starts to look a little bit more like the criminal process. We're naming the individual, and we're taking action that will disrupt their ability to access the financial system. Oftentimes, we're blocking their assets, even if we're not seizing or forfeiting their assets. And so questions start to emerge. Well, what is the process? If you were going to forfeit this person's assets, you'd have to go into court and get a judicial order. Why shouldn't you when you're going to block their assets? I think these are all very reasonable questions, but I think part of the history here is important to keep in mind. And in fact, the evolution towards targeting just a few individuals in Sudan is one aimed at vindicating, in fact, due process rights and not sweeping in huge numbers of individuals that we're not trying to pressure, and in fact, go as narrowly as possible. It's a little ironic in a way that that leads to all sorts of questions of, are we doing this in a fair way? And I don't know if those questions are resolvable, but I'll leave that for the later panelists who I think will show us a way.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Subin. The next speaker is going to be Stephen Marquardt, who is going to be talking about the EU framework for counterterrorism targeted sanctions.
Thank you very much. First of all, let me thank the American University and Ambassador Fritsch and Ambassador Werner Weser from Liechtenstein to organize this event and to have invited me. It's, as a speaker, it's an honor and pleasure to be here and to be able to make a small contribution to this important debate. I will give you a broad overview of the EU's legal framework that is relevant when we talk about targeted sanctions. Then I will also provide you with some more recent information about changes in the Council of the European Union's working methods, notably as regards due process, listing and delisting procedures, the consequences the Council has drawn from some court cases that the Council lost last year in connection with the listing of or the freezing of assets against specific individuals suspected of terrorism. And if I have some time left, I will say two words, but not more than that, about the recent Kadi judgment. Now, let me start with the EU legal framework. The EU is a rather complicated animal. It is important to describe the EU legal framework to distinguish between the European Union in a strict sense and the European Community. I mean, we all talk about the European Union being as a political entity, and that is fine in terms of projecting the EU's visibility and its presence on the international scene. But from a legal point of view, it is essential in order to understand the whole system to distinguish between the European Union on the one hand, as it was created by the Treaty on the European Union in 1993, the major features of the EU being that by that treaty, the member states for the first time have provided a treaty framework, notably for the implementation and definition of a common foreign and security policy, the CFSP. At the same time also, but that is not relevant for our discussion, the Member States also agreed on common procedures in the field of police and judicial cooperation, which are also still in existence. On the other hand, you have the treaty establishing the European Community, and the European Community as a separate entity under international law. You have to consider that both the EU and the European Community stand together as with both having legal personality under international law. The European Community, of course, has been in existence for a much longer time and had a practice of imposing sanctions against third states even before the Treaty on the European Union entered into force. There was no specific legal basis in those days. It was generally recourse was made to the legal basis for implementing a common commercial policy when it came to imposing trade restrictions, for example. Then, more or less at the same time as the EU entered into force, the EU, possibly in the EU and the UN system mutually reinforced each other, started to develop what is commonly referred to as smart targeted sanctions, and specific legal bases were introduced in the EC treaty for that purpose, namely the articles were renumbered subsequently Article 60 and 301 under the current version of the treaty. Now, how does the EU operate to impose sanctions? And here this system that I will just explain applies to all EU sanctions regimes. The EU sanctions regime, as you may know, has is divided into two sets of regimes. We have, of course, the EU sanctions that are imposed in implementation of UN Security Council resolutions, but we also have the so-called autonomous EU sanctions, where the EU, as a matter of foreign policy, took the decision to impose sanctions against a third state, but also often then against individuals linked with that third state. Cases in point are sanctions imposed by the EU against Zimbabwe and Burma, Myanmar. Now, as I said, the legal instruments that the EU resorts to are the same whether we speak of the autonomous or UN-imposed system, and the legal regime is also, the basic legal framework is also the same whether you speak about sanctions also outside the fight against terrorism. But, of course, all what I'm saying applies to also the targeted sanctions and financial sanctions in the fight against terrorism. So basically, what the EU does, and the Council of the European Union, for which I work, is the main decision-making body in that regard, when it comes to implementing or imposing sanctions, whether UN-imposed or not, the first legal act that the Council adopts is an act under the CFSP chapter of the EU treaties. So it's an act adopted by the Council, a so-called common position that defines the basic policy elements of the sanctions regime. When the Council does so in implementation of a UN Security Council resolution, you will find that this common position, which is a legal instrument under the CFSP, more or less replicates quite faithfully the language from a given UN Security Council resolution. When it is about an autonomous sanctions regime, then the Council, the Presidency of the Council defines the Presidency that normally puts forward a draft, then the Council will itself define the parameters, the criteria, conditions for the imposition of sanctions. Now, once the Council has done that, then we have in order specifically now to when we talk about freezing of assets as a form of targeted financial sanctions, a community legal act is required under the European Community Treaty, and which is adopted under the Article 60 and 301. In most cases, in some cases also, Article 308 has been added, notably for those sanctions implementing the 1267 sanctions regime. It was felt from a legal point of view, I'm not going into the details of that, that additional legal basis was necessary because the two main legal bases for imposing sanctions, in fact, only mention sanctions against third states and do not really refer to sanctions against individuals. And in the Cardi judgment, there's some interesting considerations on the Court of Justice on that aspect as well. So basically, we have a combination of a CFSP legal instrument and the community regulation. The important element about the community regulation is that, as you may know, by virtue of the EC treaty, a regulation, which is a specific form of EC legal act, is directly applicable in all the member states of the EU. That allows then the EC or the Council to impose a regulation that is the legal effects of which are applicable uniformly throughout all 27 member states. Such acts are directly applicable and binding in all the national institutions, administration, justice, and also, as the case may be, of course, and that's where we come to the court cases, they are capable of affecting individual rights. So, of course, the member states, as the case may be, may have to, when it comes to freezing of assets, implement or take some further measures on the administrative level to implement such regulations, but no legislation is in principle required anymore by the member states. Now, how does the listing work? Again, as I said, when it comes to targeted financial sanctions, as I said, we have like two different regimes at the moment, the so-called autonomous regime, which is under implementing Resolution 1373 of the UN Security Council, where the Council has developed its own procedures for putting individuals on the list. And we have the same basic legal acts for the transposition of the so-called 1267 regime, but there, in fact, until now, and Cardi may oblige the EU to change its system, until now, European community institutions, Council and Commission simply then replicated the list of names that was defined by the 1267 committee. The important element, I think, when we talk about rule of law and due process to be noted here is, of course, that all the court cases that have been mentioned result from the fact that contrary to the EU, the act adopted by the EU, namely the common position I referred to, it is a community regulation adopted by the Council insofar as it affects or any other act of the community institution insofar as it affects individual rights of persons is subject to full judicial review, and that has led to all the court cases before the Court of First Instance and the European Court of Justice that you heard about. Of course, there are certain criteria to be fulfilled for such actions to be admissible, but since we're talking about precisely targeting individual persons and freezing their assets, the courts have never seen any doubt that these conditions, the condition to be directly and individually concerned by such an act, were fulfilled. Now, let me stop there in terms of the description of the basic legal framework. I'm happy to answer questions on that later on. I'm just looking at the time. A few words about the Council working methods that the Council has developed quite recently, and that is probably also an interesting example or something that the UN and the UN debate on this subject matter may be taken into consideration. You may have heard about the famous in the meantime OMPI case before the Court of First Instance, where an individual listed under the EU's autonomous regime brought a successful action against the Council, and the Court of First Instance basically came to the conclusion, very much along the same lines as CADI, that the Council had decided to list, well, in this case it was an organization, OMPI, to list that organization and to freeze their assets without providing them for any statement of reasons, excuse me, without providing them for the opportunity to be heard, and therefore annulled the Council Legal Act on procedural grounds. Subsequently, as a result of this negative judgment, the Court developed or revised, made a full, complete revision of its own working methods in terms of listing and delisting. In a nutshell, the one procedural element that is noteworthy, all that is also available as public information, was the creation of a specific working group of the Council, working party of the Council, dedicated to examine listing and delisting requests and to provide a regular overview, a review, a six-monthly review of each individual listing. Together with that, the Council developed, or this Council working party, then developed for each individual on the EU's autonomous list a statement of case. The statement of case in the case of a first listing is communicated to the individual or entity concerned immediately after the listing decision, or in the case of a review where the Council is examining whether to maintain individuals or entities on the list, that the statement of case, or a draft rather statement of case, is notified or provided to the person or entity in question before the actual then review and listing decision is taken, and that the Council decided to do in order to fulfill the requirement of due process and of providing those persons with a hearing. So again, these are the so-called CP 931, named after the number of the relevant common position working party, and the working methods of this, and I can give you the reference if you are interested, are available as a public document from the Council. Again, also the Council felt that this was a question of making those, not only establishing those procedures, but making those procedures also transparent. Do I still have 1 minute?
Yes.
Okay.
You want to talk about,
well, that's perfect, because that's perfect, because I didn't, let me say something, quickly something about CADI, but as I said, I didn't want to speak more than 1 or 2 minutes about CADI. The CADI judgment has, and then the reason why I do not want to go into more detail on CADI, and I think maybe this afternoon my colleague Christopher Michelson might say a few words on that, because there's a specific panel on the court cases. One specific reason of that is on account of my, even if I'm here in a personal capacity, on account of my functions, I'm still too closely involved with these cases, and my colleagues from the Council Legal Service in Brussels are presently drafting or preparing a more detailed analysis of the CADI judgment, which will then be provided also to the EU member states in due course, and I don't want to preempt what they may, the conclusion they may come to. But simply, just on the main substance of CADI, on the one hand, which is interesting, I referred to that earlier, the CADI judgment has confirmed that the European Community has the power and the competence to impose such targeted sanctions, which was not from an EU or EC, rather, legal point of view, not so evident in a way. Of course, I mean, the Council's lawyers, and also in agreement with the Commission lawyers, we always thought that the treaty legal basis could also cover the imposition of targeted sanctions against individuals, even though the actual legal basis, if you look at the wording, does not refer to individuals. So the court confirmed that the combination, in fact, of these three legal bases, 60, 301, and 308 of the EC treaty was correct, and that the European Community has the basic power to impose sanctions. That's, I think, a noteworthy and important aspect of the judgment. And then, of course, the more problematic aspect of CADI, if you want, is that in spite of the fact that here we were talking about a listing decision taken by the EC in application of an obligatory UN Security Council resolution, the court said, on the one hand, recognize the supremacy under the UN Charter system of the Security Council, but notwithstanding that supremacy, the court clearly said that it nonetheless with reserved to itself the right of full judicial review of the Community Legal Act, and the Community Legal Act being, in that case, the Council regulation which it annulled, it reserved to itself the power to review any Community Legal Act, even if taken in imposition in transposition of UN resolution. And in this case, it came to the conclusion that the act adopted by the Council was in violation of higher principles of European Community Law, namely violations of due process and the right to be heard and the right to judicial review. And I'll stop here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next speaker will be Joanna Wexler, who will be talking about the UN Security Council's targeted sanction regime.
Thank you, Bob. My thanks to the Washington College of Law and to the government of Liechtenstein. I'm very honored to be included in this wonderful conference. So we'll now move from the Council of the European Union to the Security Council of the UN. And I will also be just saying Council most of the time, but it's a different Council than a moment ago. And when one thinks about Security Council and targeted sanctions to combat terrorism, obviously, the label of the resolution 1267 comes to mind with all its concerns and problems and criticisms that have already been mentioned and I'm sure will be mentioned in the afternoon in much more detail. And most of these relate to the rule of law and human rights. Most of these problems are definitely related to these two aspects. And I thought that I will start by, in order for us to better understand these concerns and problems, I will start by talking about Security Council targeted sanctions a little bit more broadly. One of the speakers has already touched upon it, but I think it's worth to look at how the Council developed its approach to targeted sanctions and where it came from. Because historically, the Council used sanctions early on in its history first of all, it used them extremely rarely. Until 1990, there were only two cases of economic or other sanctions. They were 1968 against Rhodesia and 1977 against South Africa. And they were comprehensive economic sanctions, as I mentioned. Starting in 1990, however, in the aftermath of the Cold War, when the Council suddenly had consensus and sky seemed to be the limit, the use of sanctions actually almost exploded. And in quick succession, the Council imposed sanctions in several places, and usually it was done in order to try to stop a bloody conflict. And initially, these sanctions were also comprehensive economic embargoes and arms embargoes. But soon, concerns began to be raised about the impact on sanctions. On the one hand, there were questions about the effectiveness of comprehensive sanctions and questions about whether such sanctions were at all implementable, but also, obviously, as already mentioned, about their impact on the general population of the targeted country. And on that latter issue, questions were being raised as to whether decision makers and elites did at all feel comprehensive sanctions, and they were the ones that were supposed to change their behavior with the impact of sanctions, and whether sanctions, rather than alleviate the level of suffering in a particular place on the part of the general population, did not bring more suffering to the very people they were supposed to help. And it was then when several European governments started work on making sanctions more effective and at the same time less painful for the people of the countries where they were being applied. By making the sanctions target decision makers rather than using them as blunt instruments that would target everybody in the country. And between 1998 and 2003, there were three separate tracks of meetings called from places where they took place, Interlaken, Bonn, Berlin, and Stockholm processes. Now, as I said, what we discussed today, what we will be discussing today with respect to the Security Council is jointly labeled as Resolution 1267 and the 1267 Committee. A few words about what a committee is. A council committee is usually set up to oversee a particular set of sanctions, which is also called sanctions regime. And it is named, and usually for eternity, as is the case with 1267, after the first resolution that created that committee. That committee may change, but it will still be called with that first number. And the committee is a strange creature because actually it is the entire Security Council. The only difference between the 11 currently existing sanctions committee is the person of the chair. And the chair is usually, actually it's always an ambassador from an elected country, which means that he or she stays in that post for a maximum of 2 years and usually 1 year, which also means that the only institutional memory that exists within the council is with the permanent five, and they essentially call all the shots here. So the resolution 1267 was adopted in October 1999, and it imposed sanctions on Afghanistan and the Taliban, and it included asset freezes on Taliban leaders. A few months after September 11, in January 2002, a new resolution, this time 1390, made measures of 1267 applicable worldwide and binding on all states, and expanded the mandate to go beyond the territory of Afghanistan to include individuals and entities anywhere in the world belonging or associated with the Taliban, Osama bin Laden, and the Al-Qaeda. Thus, the measures that were initially of limited application, both geographically and in terms of individuals to which they were supposed to target, became applicable worldwide and to an extremely loosely defined category of individuals and organizations. And the key feature of Resolution 1390 was the creation of the so-called consolidated list of individuals and entities to be targets of these sanctions. That system mirrored to some extent the measures imposed by executive order of September 24 in the United States, and I must say United States was very much behind the Resolution 1390. It was its initiative. However, what Resolution 1390 completely lacked were the U.S. standards of evidence and any possibility of appeal or remedies. And the way it worked was that any government, any member of the UN, could submit a name to be placed on the list, and if no member of Security Council this time, so only 15 governments, objected to the names being placed within a specified period of time, which was only 48 hours initially, that name stayed on the list. And the person or organization became subject to quite severe measures. And another very significant characteristic of this Resolution 1390 was very rudimentary rules, very vague criteria for placing names, no possibility of review, no possibility of removal, and a high degree of secrecy, including even the identity of the government that submitted the name of the person or organization. And obviously there were immediate concerns related to how individuals would be placed on the list and about the near impossibility to be ever removed from the list. And we refer to these two processes, listing and delisting, and I'm sure you will hear these terms many times today. And also there were some concerns about possible misuse of the list for repressive purposes by some governments. And essentially, the basic response from the Council's P5 permanent members was that the Council was not a judicial body and thus did not have to worry about judicial or semi-judicial rules. And I must say that there is a considerable human rights irony here, because in the period when sanctions became as a favorite tool of the Security Council, Targeted sanctions was the concept that human rights groups supported because precisely they targeted decision makers rather than shifting the burden of sanctions to the general population. And in fact, several leading human rights NGOs participated quite actively in these three processes that I mentioned before, that includes Human Rights Watch. Simply targeted sanctions were perceived as something that would limit potential human rights violations and not create new violations. There is also another important factor to keep in mind. Targeted sanctions were originally meant to be imposed against individuals in high-level decision-making positions whose identity was beyond question. These were celebrity lists. The 1267 list is a very different story. As of last August, there were 496 names of individuals and organizations on that list, so it's quite a crowd. After the imposition of or passing of Resolution 1390, horror stories started emerging quite quickly of people, for instance, with mistaken identity whose lives were suddenly put in some Kafkaesque limbo and who had absolutely no way to address the situation. Some governments, in particular Sweden, Switzerland, Liechtenstein, Germany, actually undertook tremendous and sometimes many-year lasting efforts to get their nationals or residents delisted, but that was only happening to people whose governments were willing to fight for them, and many, many governments were not interested in doing it. There were concerns raised by member states, by civil society, from within the UN system, in particular Secretary General Kofi Annan and the High Commissioner for Human Rights, but any changes were extremely slow in coming and quite minimal. And the fact that these concerns were essentially being ignored by the Security Council led the world leaders to an unusual step of including in the 2005 outcome document of the World Summit the following admonition to the Council. We also call upon the Security Council to ensure that fair and clear procedures exist for placing individuals and entities on sanctions lists and for removing them, as well as for granting humanitarian exemptions. So as of today, there have been some progress in that system, in part due to the pressure and in part out of Council's own pragmatism, and that means the realization that unless some concerns were addressed, implementation by member states was highly unlikely. But everything was very slow, and there has always been strong reluctance on the part of the P5 to make any significant modifications. And for example, it wasn't until July 2005 that a first questionnaire for governments wishing to place names on the list was developed. And following that mandate from the summit in 2005, it took the Council more than a year of quite heated internal discussions to finally, in December 2006, pass two resolutions that in part addressed some of the concerns. One of them, Resolution 1730, created a so-called focal point for sanctions, which is essentially an address, a place where entities or individuals can direct their questions or their claims of being put on this list wrongly. Until that moment, there was nothing of that sort. By the way, we have the focal point sitting here in the room, so you can probably take advantage of her presence later on and ask her some questions. And Resolution 1735, which provided some standards of information, notification of missions, also made a commitment to consider mistaken identity or deceased individuals on the list, and commitment to develop new guidelines. But this is almost 5 years later to get that amount of concessions from the Council. And most recently in June, possibly because of the looming European court cases, The Council passed yet another resolution which actually develops a lot of these procedures further and in quite great detail. However, this is Resolution 822, and it also finally has a decision, a firm decision, to review all names on the list in 2 years. So, again, it's still years ahead. And speaking of review of the names of the on the list, I suspect that Ambassador Benavizer will be talking about it later on, but there was an initiative by several European governments to create an outside review panel for the list, and so far that proposal has not received any traction from the Council. And it's important also to know that even though the Council has stated certain things in its resolutions, its own practice is sometimes an entirely different story. And for example, that Resolution 1735 strongly encouraged member states to send representatives to meet the committee for more in-depth discussion of relevant issues. Yet, despite this provision in the Council resolution, getting a meeting with the committee is actually quite difficult for a member state. And just in closing, meanwhile, the listing and delisting controversy over Resolution 1267 has had a perverse effect on the other sanctions regimes. While 1267, with all its problems and controversies, is alive and well, elsewhere we are actually seeing a clear decline in the usage of targeted sanctions, and especially as a way of dealing with a bloody conflict and a means of curbing high levels of misery, targeted sanctions ceased in 2004. After 2004, the only new sanctions have been in cases involving nuclear proliferation, such as North Korea and Iran, and in the case of suspects in the assassination of the former Lebanese prime minister in 2005. And not surprisingly, member states, which are not particularly famous for their commitment to upholding human rights standards, have been citing due process